Our main speaker tonight is Hal.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Hal. And was chatting on the phone today with Bob, and I told him the story of when I first got sober. I had gotten my 90 days, and I was asked to speak, and this was at Fast Break, which was one of the two meetings I went to very consistently when I first got sober. And I was so nervous, like I'm feeling now. And I was walking down very early in the morning to speak, and there was a young woman who had moved to New York just when I started getting sober. And I ran into her. She was an actress. She was very pretty. She was petite. And I called her the Angel of California because she was so attentive and helpful to me. And I saw her, and I said, "Oh, I'm so nervous. I'm about to speak." And first time. And she sort of smiled, and she leaned up, because she was very small, and she whispered in my ear, "Tell the truth." And that has been, any time I have the privilege to get to share my experience, strength, and hope with my fellow alcoholics, you know, like the most important thing for me to remember. That's really all I've got, is my story. And you know, I'm definitely nervous. I am a little overwhelmed, a little scared. And yet, you know, I know that about myself. You know, that's the blessing for me. You know, I have an emotional illness that I call alcoholism. And I learned here that the way I related to ethyl alcohol was a symptom of that illness. You know, early on in my recovery, I found something in the Big Book that helped me tremendously. It's been a real guide for me, and it's probably what's kept me coming back more than any other thing. And it's from the story, He Who Loses His Life, in the Big Book. And the author quotes Edna St. Vincent Millay in our Big Book. And she says, "Pity me the heart that is slow to learn what the quick mind sees at every turn." And that really had deep resonance for me early on, coming to terms with what I was dealing with, who I was dealing with, you know, what it was about me that got me where I was. And he goes on to say, I'll just read this one thing. He says, "For a while, for a long time, we can endure the intellects being ahead of the emotions," which is the import of Millay's couplet. "But as the years go by, the stretch becomes unbearable. And the man with the grown-up brain and the childish emotions, vanity, self-interest, false pride, jealousy, longing for social approval, to name a few, becomes a prime candidate for alcohol." And then this was the sentence that has meant so much to me. He said, "To my way of thinking, that is a definition of alcoholism, a state of being in which the emotions have failed to grow to the stature of the intellect." That's what I've been dealing with, by the grace of God and with your help, for 18 years. I will be, God willing, 50 years old this year. I have a graduate education from an Ivy League university. And I went through a breakup about 3 years ago. And I'm telling you, there are 13-year-old, you know, cheerleaders in Topeka, Kansas, who could have helped me deal with that better than I did. You know... That's who's talking to you tonight. You know, I have got, you know, the struggle I have had, you know, coming to terms with my emotional life. And, you know, the fix for that condition, which the language of the Big Book speaks to over and over and over. The two words in the fifth step in the 12 and 12, anxious apartness. You know, did two words ever capture more clearly my life experience from age 5 to 17. You know, that was the condition. And finding booze, you know, was the first relief to that condition. My first drink was at age 13. That first drink became my first drunk. The word drink was always a verb, never a noun in my experience, an active experience. It was not something that you just did. I remember being 3 years sober and reading an article in the New York Times on alcoholic poisoning and on college campuses. 3 years sober. And the reporter made reference or quoted a specialist in drug addiction, alcohol abuse, saying that that more than five drinks in one sitting was considered like problem drinking. I was 3 years sober, and I looked up from where I was sitting. I said, five? You know, like I was just five for like weeks. I walked around, five? You know, like, who, you know, it was like mind-numbing to me, you know, to start to get a perspective on what, where my behavior had taken me. Also around the age of 13, my mother and my aunt and my two sisters all went together to Tiger Stadium in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where I grew up, to hear Billy Graham. And I remember it vividly. And if any of, you know, this, we're in a Methodist church, and Flannery O'Connor called, you know, I'm Southern, and she called it the Christ-haunted South. You know, it's like very rich in that sort of gothic. I grew up about 2 miles from Jimmy Swaggart Ministries. So this was the impact. You know, it's like a world where things aren't so much good and bad as good and evil, you know. So there was just a lot of this very gothic guilt and shame that I was very predisposed to. But I remember going to hear him. And at the end of his service, he calls people down as part of the Christian experience. And I went. And I have joked years later saying, you know, he could have been selling handguns and I'd have gone down there. You know, it was just to get away from my mother and my sisters and my aunt, because you know, there was, and I remember that experience, and I don't mean to be flippant about that. I think something spiritual did happen for me. And, you know, in my adolescence, I did start to prize that part of my nature that I was tapping into. In fact, when I was a couple of years sober, I remember going home to my parents' house at the time where they were living, and my room was still sort of like a shrine to my childhood or something. And on the wall was the Serenity Prayer. And I didn't even know that I had put it there. So that was very touching to me. But, you know, I had a few other experiences in early adolescence of drinking and getting drunk and that incredible relief. But I think because of that spiritual experience, I stopped. And, you know, that anxious apartness, that loneliness really was just a the way of life for me. And then in college, I had the experience of sort of really getting to tap into that big shotism. You know, I became president of my fraternity. All that was so important to me, you know, being, you know, the appeasing that emotional insecurity. And then, you know, when college ended, I was just dumbfounded. Like, you know, why are we leaving here? You know, it was like, if they hadn't kicked me out of that fraternity house, I'd still be there. You know, that's like, you know, the truth of my experience. And everybody started getting married, and, you know, I was like, I don't get it. You know, it was just not making sense to me. And it was right out of college that I started drinking again. And then I moved to New York at age 25. So in those few years out of school, I'd started to drink, and I came to New York when I was 25 years old. And, you know, all I can say is, you know, I remember just being free of the driver's license. You know, I'd had a lot of bad car experiences. I never had a DWI, but I was certainly on my way toward one. And, you know, New York threw it into fifth gear for me. I remember at the Lincoln Center, there was a bus stop, and it wasn't even an advertisement so much. I don't know what it was, like a PSA or something, but it simply said, invisibility is your revenge. And that was like my mantra. You know, I could, you know, just sort of disappear and roam the city and, you know, and drink. And I dolled it up real nice. I came to go to graduate school, and I did embark on that. And I got three quarters of the way through, had been totally unrealistic about money, especially as an active alcoholic. I've told this story before, but it's kind of a signature of my active alcoholism. In those drinking years between age 25 and 31 when I came into AA, there was an actual experience where I gathered all my bills together. I had a bottle of red wine. I got some colored pens, and I wrote relax on all my bills and mailed them in. You know, and and, you know, took care of that, you know, done. And, yeah, and I'd get these calls, you know, Mr. Strickland, you know, I don't, what is, relax, you know, and, you know, but again, it was that, you know, it was just the grand, you know, a principal factor of that emotional illness for me was grandiosity. You know, it was first defined by, don't you know who I am? You know, this president of my fraternity. And then, of course, you know, moving here where, you know, who cares? You know, and then just slowly dissipating. And I'm a big believer, the only thing worse than don't you know who I am is don't you know who I was? And, you know, that sort of, like, became the condition. But, you know, the money part, you know, I you know, where, like, on the credit card bills where it says credit limit, I would, my mind, drunk, would read, you have just won. You know, and that was my experience of it. And of course, that took me to horrible places, you know, I financially and emotionally and spiritually. And I dropped out of the graduate program, which was a horrible source of shame for me. And I think the shame was starting to metastasize. And I took a job in a restaurant. And for 3 years, I worked there, a very nice restaurant about two blocks from my house. That was getting my life very small. And I became a really surly waiter. That's, I think, the best way to put it. You know, it's like just very ugly with people. And, you know, and would drink on the job and could get away with it. And, you know, and then, too, just always sort of chasing that phantom relationship that was going to change everything for me. That person outside of me that would make me whole. You know, that was that thing outside of me, that thing I was looking for. And, you know, that evolved into a messy relationship which ended. And something in that, you know, there's that line in the eighth step, too, where it says defective relations with other human beings. Was, you know, with defective relations with other human beings was the very cause of our alcoholism. So, you know, it speaks to that aspect too. And something happened there, you know, that was part of the change for me. You know, growing up in the South, being, you know, having my background, there was a line from the Psalms that kind of came in really clearly for me. And it says very simply, my spirit fainted within me. And I knew that's what had happened to me. This was September of 1989, and I was in trouble, and I knew it. And not even, you know, I could still keep sending in ridiculous things to credit card companies. I could still get by with work, but something inside had happened to me, and I knew it. And it scared me really badly. And, you know, I remember finding this book of, I had a collection of Martin Luther King sermons, and I started reading them. And a woman at my workplace, who I think God sent, you know, saw me reading it and sort of opened up to her a little bit. And I went with her to like a little Christian service in her house. And it, you know, I was trying, but it wasn't quite clicking for me. You know, and I remember I kept waiting for one of my best friends from home to come up. And I thought, if I can talk to him, I'll get better. You know, that he can help me with this. And they came and they left. And I remember we went to some grand restaurant, and all we were doing was talking all this surface stuff. And I had promised this woman I would go to her a gathering up in like near Albany of this Christian group. But I didn't realize that I would go get drunk the night before, you know, we were supposed to go. So I got in like at 4 o'clock, met them to get on a bus at 6 o'clock. To ride up to this thing in Albany. And everybody is clapping and singing, and I am like, I am gonna, you know, shoot somebody here. That's what I'll do. You know, and we got up there, and I remember, this is so funny, I think, what gets our attention. You know, C.S. Lewis said, pain is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. And I think he uses that to get our attention. And I went to out to the service, and I could not sit still for it. And I walked across the way, to the street, to this empty shopping center that was completely abandoned. And I saw in this abandoned shopping center a reflection of myself. And I had a moment there where I said, there was a woman friend of mine who I should mention who had gotten sober in AA who annoyed me beyond words. She'd be in the cab with her and she'd tell, I'd go, guess what? I'm sober in AA. And I'm like, you cannot be doing this. I was like so horrified. And but she kept trying to get me to go to meetings too. So thank you. And she, I agreed. Sitting there in that empty parking lot of that abandoned shopping mall in Albany, New York, I said, I'm going to go to an AA meeting tomorrow. I'm going to do that. She had kept pointing me in different directions. And that next day was November 5th, 1989, and I walked from my apartment on the 71st Street down to Fireside at the West Side Y. And that was my first meeting. And oh, you know, I was so moved. I'm so glad I got to speak. After all, everybody was sharing their day camps, you know, because it just still moves me so much. I heard 11 days. I heard 25 days. I heard 64 days, you know, one after another. And just, you know, every single one of you, you are without doubt the most important people here. I think all of us could vouch for that. You know, and each day right now is just beyond heroic, you know, and so just getting yourself here, it's hard. It's hard to do this. You know, it's hard to let go, you know, and I think to change. I mean, I've joked that whole first year sober, I could have, like, taped the back of my palm to my forehead, you know, and just marched around town. You know, just the self-pity was just oozing, you know, so incredibly. You know, I remember I legitimately had the thought, you know, the government should pay me for this, you know. That was my, you know, the way I sort of rationalized it. But, you know, I showed up there, and you know, for the first 5, 6, 7 days, I didn't say a word. I didn't say a word to anyone. A friend of the woman who had been trying to get me to come to AA spoke at my very first meeting. And you know what? I thought he was cool. So that got me to my second meeting. You know, it was that the way that worked. But I didn't say a word. And then the night, and I didn't say a word to anybody. I don't think I even told her I had gone. I was keeping it totally to myself because I wasn't really going to do this. You know, and when I had 6 days, that night, I had a dream. And in that dream, a woman from my high school, Gracie H., I'll call her, you know, what Gracie was her name, who had been a dear, dear connection for me. In this dream, she descended this beautiful stairwell, and she was lit from behind, and it was a huge smile on her face, and she said these words to me. She said, "Have you confessed this?" A big smile. And I said, "What?" Big smile again, lit even more from the back. And she said, "Have you confessed this?" And I said, "What?" And big smile. And she said, "One more time, have you confessed this?" And I said, "What?" And woke up. And I sat down and I, you know, with what spiritual reference I had, I went to my Bible and I looked up the word confession in the back and I got reference to a verse that said, "Confess your sins to one another." And I looked up from the book and I said, "I have to say I'm an alcoholic." And that was my moment of clarity. That was my first step. That was the start. And I marched down that day to Fireside, day 7, and I raised my hand and said I was an alcoholic. And you know, the way this process works, the way the steps work, just a source of absolute fascination to me. You know, the word we admitted, first step we admitted, fifth step we admitted, tenth step we admitted. And it's really physics. You know, the minute we admit it, we're admitted. You know, the way that works. And that's what happened for me. You know, I started, you know, my second day there, there was a celebrity there, a big celebrity. So remember my grandiosity? So I thought, oh, I'll get him to sponsor me. You know, I'll let him, you know, was pretty much the attitude. Well, you know, God was looking after him. I didn't see him again for like a year. So, you know, he saved himself from that approach. But there was a guy there who was really not like me at all. Real tough guy. I found out later he'd been in prison, 2 years younger than me. And he was about 3 years sober. And about 50 days, so it was right at November 5th, right around Christmas. Things got a little hairy around family. And I decided to ask him to sponsor me. And he did, Todd C. And he sponsored me that next 3 years. And what a blessing. You know, the way sponsorship works, I've had 3 sponsors in my year sober, Todd C., Jim H., and Lonnie M., and they've each given me incredible gifts. And I've had the privilege of sponsoring other people too. But Todd was an incredible help, and I just dug into meetings. You know, that's what I did. And I will tell you, especially for everyone who's new, you know, I was so unhappy. You know, I just, first of all, I really did, was beset by the thought, I can never drink again. You know, this felt like an unimaginable curse to me. 31 years old, and I can never drink again. I could not even begin to see that that could be a good thing. You know, nowhere near. But I kept coming. You know, it was a horrible, horrible curse in my mind. And I kept coming, and when I got to 90 days, which happened to be Groundhog Day, November 5th to February 2nd. I remember that for some reason. And I remember going down to the meeting, and I celebrated my 90 days, and by this time, I'd started to make a few connections and with people. And I remember sitting in the room afterwards, and I was still really miserable. And I share that for anyone who's new, you know, that was a condition that lasted a while. I didn't, you know, I was getting some relief, but I wasn't happy about this. And if you're not, it's okay. You don't have to be, but you can show up. You know, in that first 90 days, what was the complete source of fascination to me was the meeting started on time. You know, that's what, I'd go, let me just go down there and see if they'll start it on time again. I was so fascinated by this, you know. And yet, that little principle, practicing our principles, guess what I do now? You know, working and being successful and all the gifts that have come. I show up, and I'm on time, you know. And it was like, that was the first little seed of like, okay, this is how you live. This is what you do to live a decent life. But at 90 days, I remember having the very clear thought, you know what, Hal? This is still a curse. The government still should pay you to do this. You know, all of that insanity. I said, but you know what? I could finally face, I was better off that day, that Groundhog Day, than I would have been otherwise. And I knew it. I knew that was true. And I think I was on my way there. So, in my first 90 days, I heard a qualification that had a tremendous impact on me. It was a man named Dennis. It was somewhere in those like 53, 54 days. And he said two things that I've never forgotten, and they were sort of keepers for me. He spoke of this disease as a state of, he spoke of it as possessing a malignant sense of entitlement. And I've never forgotten that phrase. You know, what you're supposed to be doing for me to make me okay. You know, a complete abstracted framework to deal with life, but believing it. And he spoke of this condition as one of malignant narcissism. You know, I think our language is a little more gentler with it. You know, self-centered in the extreme, you know, those things. You know, what did the alcoholic say when he dropped the priceless vase at the Metropolitan? I'm okay. You know, you know, but you know, just how we see ourselves at that center, you know, completely at that center. And to me, this is where, you know, the steps have been transformative. You know, the journey in Alcoholics Anonymous for me has really been through the path offered by the steps. And they, you know, are so astounding to me. And the thing that I see that means so much to me in the steps is in the first step, we admitted we were powerless. And, you know, 18 plus years sober by the grace of God and through your help, I don't, to this day, there's a part of me that doesn't like that about myself, but you know what? I love knowing it. I love knowing it. The gift of being in touch with that truth about myself has just been a catalyst for so many other things, because it's that self-awareness that has helped me to evolve as a human being. So the steps became key. I think that first step, which is demonstrated every time we go to a meeting, my experience with simply stating I was an alcoholic and what that meant. And my third step became in coming to believe, showing up. You know, we came to believe, that little cliche. And, you know, then the third step really became that reconnection with that spirit for me. You know, really starting the process of turning my will in my life, our will in our lives, you know, over. And so, so, so importantly to me here. And I think this was so crucial to me, really starting to separate what was belief in God from having a higher power. They're two very different things for me, but making that very real and sort of alive in me. And the, what did is, and I think this is where these steps are such genius, you know, it really did become the understanding what I'm turning my will and my life over to,
thank you,
is the care of God. You know, and that is so important, that distinction. And, you know, I love words and their meaning. That's what I studied. I will say, sober, I went back and got that graduate degree I had left, which meant a lot to me. And, you know, the care and the words. And if you look at the word care, its etymology is from the Latin, meaning to lament with. So I'm turning my will and my life over to the care of God, like for his care for me, that these are things, you know, that I can trust. You know, I think it was really starting to see, and I didn't talk much about this, but, you know, my abuse in childhood, all the things that, you know, that sense of being victimized, all of those things that seem to justify erroneously, but nonetheless, that malignant sense of entitlement, were not happening to me, but were happening for me. And that was the transformative piece for me. You know, that the gift of my alcoholism in that way, what it was designed to do to help me spiritually. And I think that's what's freed me. You know, I'll say this. This was a major discovery for me in my recovery about myself. And I was sober about 5-6 years, and I mentioned that emotional illness. And I had a moment sitting in a meeting. This happened a few times. It was right before my 6th anniversary. And I was sitting in a meeting, and every now and then this happens. My therapist calls it hypnagogic reverie. But, you know, I'm not schizophrenic, I don't think. But I would hear this little voice. And the voice said to me these words, "You can feel it all." And I was 6 years sober. I thought, what does that mean? You know, when I was 90 days sober, I had immediately found some therapy, and I was in such a state, and I was saying to the therapist at the time, I said, you know, I miss talking about the booze in my head. And he said, the euphoria? And I wanted to kill him. You know, how dare you? You know, that I was so dependent on a constant state of euphoria and couldn't and needed to open up to the fullness of an emotional life. And, you know, that's what that little voice came to be. And I can tell you, 18 years sober, you know, when I was early sober, I'd hear someone who'd gone out at 20 years or something. I'd say, that doesn't make any sense. They must have stopped going to meetings. I'd have that thought. I get it. You know, as human beings, I mean, I 12 years sober, I hit right after September 11th some grief that if I hadn't had every minute of my recovery, I don't know if I could have experienced. But guess what? I felt it. You know, and I grew from it. And the big discovery I was going to mention for me was this, and that is I realized that all of the suffering I ever experience, all of the pain for me, is always the same. It's in the tension between what is and what I think it should be. And my ego will always tell me that the solution is in what I think it should be. And I've learned in AA that the solution is also available in the surrender to what is. Now, on the surface, that's not enough. If I don't have a third step to bring that to, it's no deal. But if I can start to trust that in that state of what is, and that the steps can facilitate that, there's balm for the suffering and even something better for me. And that's what that care is. And that's been my experience. You know, for anyone who's new, you know, everything in the years before, you know, that getting sober and the years since that I thought I wanted, you know, thank God I didn't get it, you know. So I've just been given the 1 minute. And just to close, I was thinking, I wanted to share this. You know, I love words, their meaning, and I just wanted to close with a little poem. It's just very short. It's one Robert Frost, one stanza. But it meant a lot to me. And I think it's so important. It's been so important to me as an alcoholic to start just treasuring my life. You know, I started off this meeting feeling a little nervous, a little overwhelmed. But, you know, I'm so grateful to Bob asking me to speak. So grateful to be here in, you know, this renowned meeting and the privilege of getting to speak, like both of my fellow speakers said. But this little poem of Robert Frost I love, it's one stanza, four lines, and it's called A Question. And he says, a voice said, look me in the stars and tell me truly, men of earth, if all the soul and body scars were not too much to pay for birth. So I'm so thankful for the chance to speak. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.